What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hatmes, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Ahmet Temetkin, and we speak about motivation, what it is that really drives our behavior, and how knowing about motivation buttons helps us to be better facilitators, better team leaders. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Hello, Ahmet. Or is it Ahmet?
Hello. It is Ahmet, yes.
Ahmet.
Yes. Usually in Turkey, we don't pronounce the H, so it's Ahmet.
It's more the Arab Ahmet and the Turkish Ahmet.
But I don't make an issue out of it. Actually, when I first moved to the UK, they found my name so difficult to pronounce that they called me Arnold Pumpkin. Ahmet Temetkin became Arnold Pumpkin. So some people call me Arnold Pumpkin, but mostly it is it's Ahmet Temetkin. I've got my little dog who is absolutely wanting to have attention. Will not give it to him.
Let's see how we can contribute to our conversation. And indeed. I'm excited to talk to you about motivation. And I always open the podcast conversation with the same question. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
Okay, I tell you why. But, you know, when we talked about your standard questions, that was the moment I said, oh, I am a facilitator. Because I normally call myself a coach, coaching people in management, coaching groups of management, top executives and things like that. But I never sort of thought that I was a facilitator. When I saw your question, I said to myself, oh my God, I am a facilitator. Because in a way, a coach facilitates someone through their thinking process to achieve certain objectives or state of emotions. So actually, I am, since something like 2-3 days, I call myself as well a facilitator. Right. Not only for individuals, also when you do group coaching is very much a facilitation process. You facilitate people identifying their important objectives, finding solutions to it. It's a facilitation process, actually.
Yeah. And I like the distinction. It's like facilitation is the process and coaching is maybe the inner journey.
It is indeed. So we can talk about semantics, but they are very close to each other.
Yeah. And how did you get into coaching?
Well, I had a career in supply chain, a great career. You know, I was like European logistics director of this company, of Mattel, of Tenneco, group president of a logistics group and so forth. But you know, I hated what I was doing. I didn't like logistics. Never like containers and trucks and ships never excited me. And one day I was flying from Singapore to Amsterdam. Someone sat next to me and talked to me about someone called Anthony Robbins. I don't know whether you know that. And so I couldn't avoid the conversation. So we talked until the morning. I started reading books about Anthony Robbins. One day when I was in Los Angeles, I realized that he had a training course the next week. So I asked my boss, I said, can the company pay for my course? They said, yes.
Of course.
And then I realized something motivates me a lot, it's like until you see the real love, you don't know what love is. And it's the same thing for the thing you do. And I said, I love this, makes me excited. I want to read more about it and I should do it. And when you are at a senior management position, you always say, don't be stupid, be logical. You earn so much money. You've got so many secretaries, so many drivers and so forth. And then I said, no, I don't want to die without having done what I like doing. And I went and I resigned. And at the time I was in Turkey, no one knew me. I had no like a big business connection because most of my connections were made in Belgium, Holland, and the UK. And people who knew me as a supply chain person.
Mm.
But it's incredible. Accidentally, I did a coaching for someone working for the Roche Corporation. That person spoke to another person. Then suddenly it became five people. Then it went into another company. And then suddenly I found myself coaching executives from several companies. And my, you know, all my day was very much devoted to coaching. So that's how it started. When I think about it now, I say, wow, what a stupid move. You know, you leave your well-paid job to do something you like. And it did pay off. Wonderful. I love it.
Beautiful. And for those who are not watching the video, the spark in your eyes when you're telling the story of the big move and the impact of Tony Robbins. Did your employer want the money back for the training with Tony Robbins after you resigned?
No, he didn't. My employer, my boss, had the view that someone in your team, if they want to do something different, even like to become a ski teacher or air hostess or whatever, they should pursue it. It's good for the company. It's good for the person. Only people who love doing what they are doing should stay in their jobs.
Mm.
In that way, my employer got rid of the sort of having to pay a redundancy cost to me. And I went pursuing what I love doing.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Beautiful. And you said that you got excited about coaching and started to read everything about it. So you felt this motivation, that's what you said. This Absolutely. Intrinsic motivation to pursue something new. And now you developed an entire business around motivation.
Exactly, yes.
So when did that connection start? When did you get curious about motivation? And what does motivation actually mean?
It started by accident. I was giving a training course about influencing people. And I was trying to make the point to people that don't use the arguments that will excite you to influence people. Mm-hmm. Try to read what would influence that person. And then I realized that if I did a little paper test and asked some questions, people would find out that everyone in that training course were excited from different things. And I did that paper test. I distributed it. And it was for a big American company. And they said, can we buy this test? Then I met a person who wanted to do it, digitalizing it. This is how we started. And then little by little, I realized that immense power we all have within us, something called motivation.
Mm.
When we are motivated, we are fully behind a certain objective. We really want to achieve things. We feel happy. And if we are doing something just because it's rational to do it, we do it, but we are not happy and we often don't do it that well. So it didn't happen in like one day. It was a process of me realizing what an important thing motivation is.
And thank you for sharing the story. And now I wonder, where is the distinction between motivation and passion?
Okay. I don't know the answer to that question. This is what happens in the what we call the limbic system of our brain. And it functions differently from the way our rational brain works, okay? And in the limbic system, you can be motivated, for example, from a conversation, but that cannot turn into a passion. And then sometimes you change the state from motivation to passion. And it is completely irrational. In the same time, it's beautiful. It's a hypnotic state where you find all the resources within you and direct it towards something that you love.
Mm. So how do you first find what motivates you? Or is it something personal? Or is it something general? You mentioned the test. So And you mentioned that you have to speak to people to convince them. So what is motivating them? How do you know?
Well, over the years, it became almost like a professional habit to read what motivates people for me. Okay, so there's a theory from a guy called McClelland who says that at work, we are motivated from three basic things, either from business or from our connection with other people or from feeling powerful. Okay, so mm-hmm. those three things. And there are subgroups of that. Like when you say from doing a good job, you can be motivated, but it can be because you are a perfectionist or you want to do things fast or you want to reach objectives or be logical, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So, and all of us give the signals of what motivates us. When we speak to other people, we actually shout at people indirectly what motivates us. If it's, for example, logic, we give little signals. We listen to the person and says, what is the logic behind this? I don't understand. That would be a stupid thing to do. So that's a signal about what motivates us. Or if it's like connection with other people, we would say, but it does, it's, you would earn money with that, but what would it do to people? You would make so many people upset. So actually, from our body language, whether we look and into the person, making the person feel good, or from the questions we ask, from the objections we make, we actually give signals of what motivates us. I had once read also that the metaphors we use are a good sign of what motivates us. When we give metaphors, something like we were hand in hand with people, or something like he pushed his fist on the table. These are metaphors. These mm-hmm. are images. And the images are only produced from that limbic system of our brain, because our limbic system works with images, not with words or numbers. If you read the metaphors people use, you also see what motivates them.
And I'm thinking of something that I heard somewhere before is what word we are using to express our own state. So I see what you mean, as opposed to yes. I hear you, as opposed to I feel you, I am with you.
Exactly. Those are actually little signals to the our inner world. And if you are careful, you read this. You see, because the person actually does everything to show whether the person wants respect or whether the person wants good connection with you or the person wants to do a good job, mm-hmm. shouts at you. What is difficult is the fact that for any individual, we find it very difficult to understand that someone else can be motivated from a completely different thing than ourselves.
Yes.
And then, for example, imagine that I am motivated from being very logical and taking the right decisions, and you are motivated from good connection. And you start saying all the things, nice things about us having this connection. My brain would tell me, this woman is digressing. Why is she speaking about this? We are talking about a business decision, and she's saying things like, before we talk about this business decision,
then you will
tell me about how you feel.
You might feel manipulated or exactly. that you're wasting your time.
Indeed. Yeah. Generally, we either think that the person is stupid mm-hmm. or we think that the person has another purpose that is hidden, or that the person wants to irritate you on purpose. Our brain, and that is the third part of our brain, which is the serpent, not the serpent, lizard part of our mm-hmm. brain, which is it's all about protecting ourselves. That one, when that part of the brain sees things that we don't understand, we feel there's an attack on us.
Okay? Yeah, the fight, flight, freeze.
Exactly. Response. Exactly. Yeah. Indeed. So that's the three parts of our brain, very logical part, very emotional one, and the one about power.
Beautiful. And it just reminds me of when I work with groups, there are participants who would ask for the agenda, who are really into the details, who want to know very clearly what comes when. And I'm more of the big picture person. So
right.
I learned that, okay, it's how their brain work and they love the details. It doesn't mean that I'm not good enough in providing guidance. It's just what they need. And now I understand what you mean. It's so easy to feel attacked by someone asking for more details if we're a high-level person or the other way around, only at the high level.
Exactly.
Someone who actually needs the details.
Exactly.
And is motivated by it.
Exactly. In a way, and then we come to the major topic of facilitation. In meetings, if you are not excited from something and one of the participants is excited about it, is motivated from something, it is very normal for the facilitator to feel offended or upset or not understanding it. And you would want to push that person and would say, no, we don't want to lose ourselves in detail, or please cut it short or something like that. But you cannot stop people.
Mm.
You see, like the way we are, we need oxygen. We need our motivation buttons to feel satisfied in meetings like this. So a good facilitator reads the different motivators of the participants and feeds them, not to the extent of killing the purpose of the meeting, but enough for everyone to feel they are motivated in the meeting.
And this is very interesting that you mentioned the person who likes to share and to speak. So what motivates them, I would assume, is the recognition or knowledge.
Indeed. You see, also sometimes signs can be misleading. Mm-hmm. You can look at something, someone, from the actions you can think it's recognition. It can be recognition. It can be connecting with other people. It can be displaying oneself. See, I counted three things. So in a way, the reason can be different behind the behavior. It's just that you need to feed that request.
And so two questions come up. One is, how do you know? So how can you maybe find out the distinctions? So is it recognition or is it showing off? And then how can you feed it in other ways than giving them the stage that might distract or annoy?
Okay, the first one is easier than the second question. I realize that good communicators, when they see a sign, for example, I see a sign from you and then I think that, for example, you like recognition, although your one is very much about curiosity, about finding out. I can see the signs from you. Good communicators, once they see that sign, they test it. For example, I see that you are curious, you want to find out about things. I can give you information. I can tell you something about some academic work. And if I see that your excitement goes on, then I've got it. Then Miriam is excited from information. But for example, if the reason you are asking lots of questions is because you want to be feel secure, then I can test it in another way. I can challenge your beliefs and see how you react. You see, good communicators, once they see the sign of motivation, they do few tests.
Mm.
Sometimes even they try some conflicts. I've seen that. So they meet a person. Within the first 20 minutes, they create a conflict just to see the reaction. They say, that jumper doesn't go with your hair color or something like that. And see how the person will react, whether they would back off and say, maybe I haven't chosen the right jumper, or whether they sort of dismiss it or something. And believe me, I don't think that people do this in a conscious way. But good communicators always try to find out, create the persona, the profile of the person, so that they can have an effective communication with the other one.
Fascinating. I'm still digesting on the effectiveness of starting with a conflict, because then how can you smoothen it once you know.
You can always, if I see that you get offended, I can always turn it around.
Mm.
I can always, you know, it's a problem if I dwell on it.
Mm.
But I have tried it and I've seen the sign, I can soften it.
So it's more of a poking and then
Correct.
Depending on the reaction.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. I can say something like, I think in my old age, my eyes don't see well, etc., something like that. Or I ask that question just to see whether you are aware about your beauty. Something that I can turn it around everything. and it's a beautiful dance between two people trying to find out about each other and express themselves, customized for that other person.
So, and I understand why the second question is more difficult, because it's actually really a facilitation question, how to satisfy someone's motivation for exposure and knowledge sharing in a good context. I thought there might be a motivation. Maybe if they're motivated by this, then something else could also motivate them that takes less space.
When you are motivated from something, and that could be from speaking a lot, you are so full of yourself that if someone stops you abruptly, you feel terrible. Mm-hmm. And the person who stops you have to pay this, okay? And there's a punishment.
Nice, yeah.
One way or the other. Either I punish you by not participating afterwards, I punish you by finding out the mistakes you make throughout the meeting and so forth. So I avoid this. I let people feel that what they are doing is a normal thing, it's a natural thing. And then once they have done it for a little while, then I stop it. Different than immediately stopping it. And that's a very important thing. Facilitation is an art. You are like a chef d'orchestre, and you have to let the violins make their voice and the flutes and things like that. So you have to make sure that everyone is welcome. Every different motivational profile is welcome. But we have a business to do as well.
Yeah. And that's true. So if it's the first time you're facilitating a group, you're not aware of the person who talks a lot anyway.
Yeah.
And then if it becomes a thing, then you can find strategies on giving them a different way to express.
Indeed. Not in facilitation, but in coaching, one of my challenges in the beginning was like you ask a person a question and then sometimes a yes or no question, and the person takes about 10 minutes to answer that, okay? I was trained from business life to say, don't waste my time, that was not my question, answer it correctly. Then I realized, no, don't do that. Do I have an extra 8 minutes? I do have an 8 minutes. I can recover it from another way. So I let the person express themselves. Because even if you push it, you will not create communication. So it's very important.
Yeah, that's a totally different conversation and still interesting. Where the difference then in facilitating a one-on-one conversation, the coaching situation versus a group, where the group is always the balance, how much space do you allow to one person taking away from the others?
Correct.
And I agree with you. And sometimes it's very valuable what one person says for a long time.
Indeed. And that is the art part.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you don't only read the person you are speaking to or listening to, you read other people's reaction. And then immediately you take that other person and ask for the contribution or say something. So there's a, rather than regimented, probably I want to say is that, rather than putting regimented rules, harsh rules, a good facilitator has to make sure everyone feels welcome with their different personality, but without other people feeling bad. And it's not an easy thing. I cannot just write one golden rule is this to do that.
Yeah.
You find it creatively at that moment.
Yeah. And you spoke about the motivation profile of people,
yeah,
which makes me think of personality profiles or personality tests.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that our motivation is something like our personality? And how flexible is it? Does it change? Or are we born with our intrinsic motivation?
I believe that McLellan says that those three things are actually developed in your childhood or in your adulthood. Like, for example, a parent that all the time recognizes what you have done. Oh, Miriam, you're the most wonderful child in the world, and you achieved this. For example, you feed a certain part of your emotion. Actually, what happens is with every experience, if it makes us happy, our brain produces hormones that make us feel happy. And our brain remembers that and wants to repeat that experience several times. For example, you got a good mark and your parents have said, well done, and you felt all those hormones. Your brain says, repeat that. It was really good feeling. So your brain learns over the time to reach those happiness hormones through a certain path.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes, and it's a very difficult thing, we sometimes overdo this. For example, if we are happy from making other people happy, and then eventually you find that the quality of life is horrible because you work for other people and not for yourself, you feel unhappy. You don't change from one day to another. Usually, all of us change with a terrible, terrible experience. And we pay a big debt and then say, never again. It's like your workshop name is never done before. Never in the future. Never in the future. You can change with those things. Also by little things. You experience new happinesses that you haven't experienced in the past. And then you say, oh, that's a good thing. I suppose, for example, when we are young, we experience the happiness of recognition or excitement. But when we start sort of going to school and starting to work, we experience other new happinesses like, oh, finishing a task and getting, doing a good job or something like that. So it does change over the time, sometimes by horrible bad experiences, sometimes by awareness, usually coach or something like that, or people around you feel, or the feedback you receive from the people at work, you realize that this is not working for you. So it does change.
Mm. That's actually good news, especially the example you gave that when we recognize that what motivates us is making other people happy and constantly working for them and thereby forgetting about ourselves. I think that's indeed what many coaches and facilitators can also relate to.
Indeed. That was in my motivation buttons test. That was like peaking, making other people happy. And that is why I had gone into that business. I love people find happiness through my contribution. You know, there is a saying, what makes a poison is the quantity you consume. Or maybe we just say it in Turkish, that thing. So, for example, you know, if you drink a little bit of alcohol, it's not a poison, but if you drink bottles of it, then it can kill you. Same thing. Making other people happy is a great thing. Mm-hmm. It's the quantity that is the problem. Yeah. If you overdo it, or you do it in a situation where you shouldn't be doing it, then it becomes a poison. But being logical is the same thing. Being objective-oriented is the same thing. Being responsible is the same thing. Asking for respect is the same thing. Everything has a balance. So the quantity of it is a problem. And that being too logical or too responsible or too wanting too much respect can be too much. We can change that over the time by increased awareness. And probably a good coach shows you the consequences of you overdoing things. I will now turn it around to the other point. Is probably if a person draws the happiness, draws the motivation from making other people happy, that's also the strength of that person.
Mm.
It's just doing it with a little bit of conscience, with awareness, and not overdoing it. And you keep your strength, but do it the right level.
And that's interesting. So if I understand correctly, what motivates us becomes our strength because it's rather effortless. So if I'm motivated by understanding things, then this is my strength because I want to understand things and I don't need the extrinsic motivation to do that.
When I heard that sentence, I almost wanted to go and write down your sentence is what motivation is our strength, because it's effortless, beautiful sentence. It is like that. When, for example, there was a fashion at that moment where everyone was becoming coach, and I could hear, because you could earn money and things like that, I could hear some of my colleagues to say, how can you listen to people talking about their problems for an hour? I mean, I find that unbearable. Doing two sessions a day is already too much, because they were doing something which requires effort from them. Whereas I naturally want to make people happy, or some other people are naturally searching for information. Some other people are naturally logical and things like that.
Very interesting. And I'm thinking back of what you said about the personality, and that we all have our motivation buttons or motivation profiles. And would you think that it's similar that for a team, it makes sense to have a certain distribution or variation of motivation? Or does it make more sense to have a similar motivation? Or maybe it depends. Most probably.
Yes. Depending on what that team is trying to achieve, yes, you have to have in that team various parts, people who keep the happiness, who take care of the happiness of the group, people who make sure that it's logical, people sort of who make sure that communication is complete and so forth. So that is very good. And they should not crush one another. But on the other hand, I have done the motivation buttons test for several companies, like hundreds of people in the same company. And so that different companies, say in the pharmaceutical sector, they have been successful as a group by being motivated from things which are different than the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Let me call company P, someone think that starts with P. As a group, I can see that they are motivated from being competitive, from basing their decisions on numbers, objective-oriented. But I know another pharmaceutical company, let's call that T, and they are successful by being patient, by taking long-term decisions, by encouraging collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So actually, I don't think that all groups should be alike. Not all people should be alike. Not all groups should be alike. Their profile should not be a problem for them. Let's take, if they are over objective oriented, then that has got downsides as well. They have to make sure that
they neglect collaboration, for instance, because of that.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Or exhaust their employees. Which then made me think, so there is a DISC model, right? With the four colors, the red, the yellow, the green, the blue. And if I remember correctly, then the blue ones are more the analytical ones, right?
Yeah.
And maybe the green. Yeah, the blue ones, I think, are analytical and into numbers and details. Is there a very strong correlation then between the motivation and the personality profile? Or would you think that a person who is red, who is very goal-oriented and DISC, would be motivated by something else than results?
The personality test, like DISC, is one of the examples, and there are several others, tells you about your personality, how you behave.
Mm-hmm.
Motivation tells you why you behave like that.
The driving force.
Exactly. And actually, for example, you can try to do a good job because you want to please people, or because you are curious about numbers and make sure that it's perfectly done, everything is perfectly done. The reasons behind your behavior can be different.
Thank you.
Often, reading a personality test does not change your personality, but reading the motivations behind them, you can change your behavior. You say, oh my God, I am asking for a little bit too much respect. And then maybe the fact that you are going into conflicts because of that, shutting people out and so forth, then you can change your behavior. Because you understand that the reason and the quantity of your motivation.
Yeah. And then I can imagine that it's beneficial. So as much as teams do the personality test to understand how they communicate and how they deal with each other, I can imagine that as a team leader, if you understand your team members' motivations, then you can basically replace extrinsic motivation, like bonus systems or praise or whatever extrinsic motivation there are, by emphasizing the intrinsic motivation?
Yeah, there's the intrinsic, which is naturally coming from within you, and extrinsic one, which is coming from outside. Recognition is an extrinsic thing, you know, and perfectionism is more intrinsic. So maybe I take it from that angle of a team leader. For a team leader, it's imperative that that person reads what motivates their teams. When I first became a manager, because I was very objective oriented at the time, I was trying to excite my team saying that we achieved so many things and we achieved this. Some people liked it. Some people would look at me like, you know, what is he talking about? Then I realized that different people in my team are motivated from different things, and I have to feed all their motivations. I realized it in 5 minutes. It took me several years, maybe a decade or so, to realize everyone is motivated differently. And a good team leader recognizes that his or her reasons of motivation is not the same for everyone in the team.
Yeah. And is motivation something? So do you think that people are generally aware of their motivation? So I'm imagining a situation where a team leader, and it can also be a facilitator, has a conversation with a participant or a team member asking, so, okay, so what motivates you to do this job or to come to this training and thereby learning about it? So do you think people are generally able to express it? Or is it something that is so unconscious that reveals through their behavior?
I think the answer is in between the two. So, for example, we always take the example of big recognition. Let's take the recognition. You know, usually you ask the person and then they would either say, I love recognition.
But there's shame attached.
Or they would say, I'm a very modest person. I don't need recognition. But they do need massive amounts of recognition. So the answer is in between. Some people are very well aware of what motivates them. Some people are completely unaware. Mostly in the test, first of all, we check what motivates that person. And then we ask that person, what motivates you? I would say in average, we get about like 80% overlap.
That's good.
It's good. It's just that 20% is usually can be killing. I remember someone, for example, was like, I can give the example of recognition. This person would say, I'm a very modest person. I don't want it. And then you realize that all the answers actually was leading to the fact that the person needed recognition. Or I remember an example when the person was saying that he is an angel, but all the answers showed that he was not motivated from making other people happy. And it was more about things related to himself that he was being happy. Now, that person, even if it's 20%, so it's one item that you get wrong, it can be killing. People can hate you for not knowing your behavior.
Yeah. And yeah, I can imagine that it's very difficult because it's a weird blind spot.
Yes.
And then if someone is so unaware of their real motivation, then, well, basically their behavior is then driven by something called cognitive dissonance, so that they have the self-image, oh, I am an angel. I believe that I'm an angel. And then they will constantly try to find arguments to align the reality to how they feel about themselves. So they feel fine.
I think I know people like that.
Well, it makes perfect sense to to dismiss others.
Yes.
And to be competitive and to talk them down.
In a way that, because I know in real life, some people in my life like that, I know that these people also push the other. I am an angel, which means that you are not an angel. Eh? I am the only angel. I am the most angel person in the world. So they sort of, the behavior becomes very irritating and they don't see it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, this very toxic behavior. And then to find, and actually the difference between their own perception and the outcomes of the test is then a good sign.
Yes. I think what I find very useful in the motivation buttons test is that it's actually a mathematical test. So I can say, you know, John, your need for recognition is 50% more from all the other people in your level, for example. And that begs for thinking, you know, you say, oh, that's numbers are saying this.
So it's a relative test. So it's not about you are a level 7 out of 10, which means or doesn't mean anything. It's a 7 out of 10.
You compare yourself to other people.
And it's so within an organization or within a team or within a benchmark of all your numbers.
For example, we've got a test which compares people to CEOs, okay? So all the other C-levels and CEOs or people who want to be CEO one day, we say, yeah, but your decision-making logical level is very, very low compared to all the hundreds of other CEOs. What can you say about that?
That's a very juicy conversation because then it assumes that all the CEOs are doing a good job. It assumes that the CEOs are the perfect CEOs. Right?
Yes. But I do believe, you know, in the world of CEOs, certain levels of behavior or motivation
got them there.
And if you see that, for example, being rational, let's take the most obvious, this is the top reason. So in the CEO test, being rational is the top motivation reason for the CEOs. And if you see the person is not rational, but is motivated from making other people happy, yes, there is a problem there. Houston, there is a problem there.
Is being rational a motivation or is it rather an outcome of the motivation being understanding the world and finding maybe links?
I would argue that these are two different things. We have got two different motivation things. You can spend hours trying to understand things without creating a rational connection between them and drawing them to
using logic. Yeah.
I remember someone who was trying to, for example, decide on what is ideal for their career. And this person wrote to me a 3-page letter about all the things I am excited from this, I don't like this. And the last sentence I remember was, but I don't know what I should be doing. So there could be a lot of analysis without any motivation for connecting this data for a rational decision.
Okay. Now I understand. Thank you. How do you use this motivation buttons test for your group coaching work, if you do?
There are several ways we use it in groups. Sometimes you can take a management team and then you do a motivation test for those managers or the executive team. Okay. First of all, we give feedback to them saying that you are too much motivated from this and too little motivated from that. Then when we bring the people together, we talk about each person's motivations and also demotivations. And sometimes it's very eye-opening. You suddenly say, oh, so if I speak too long, Miriam gets annoyed. You don't recognize it. And then you suddenly realize that the 12 people in the room can be motivated from different things. And then you say, okay, this be normal to be motivated from different things. So actually usually for the executive teams, it's a great tool to understand that the user, you get the user guide for the other person.
Okay. And I love the user guide for the other person.
Indeed. Yeah. I remember there was like an executive team where a person didn't like the other person, and they realized that they both were big boss, so that were they wanted to convince other people of their ideas, and they suddenly realized, oh, this is why we are fighting all the time. Maybe we should a little bit do this less to understand better, or we should listen to each other's ideas more. So I told you about the one application, which is extremely useful. I actually attached to that a Winfrey, who was the lady, I forgot an interview with that person. Mm-hmm. So I also spent 20 minutes with each person. Explain to me why they think that they are motivated from this. And it's incredible. Then people tell the story behind it. They say, because, for example, that my parents never recognized me, and therefore I make sure that when people come to me, I recognize them, I make them happy, because I know the unhappiness that can come from lack of recognition. And then you suddenly, so you know, you have the behavior, which you usually know, you know the motivation behind it, and the story behind it. Mm. And then you suddenly, the person stops being the finance director, the operations director, the person becomes John, Sarah, Claudia, and so forth. So then suddenly people with their stories come along.
And I think suddenly they're not the annoying people who speak too much or who know everything better or who always want to connect on such a deep level. But indeed, you understand where they're coming from, and therefore it's easier to empathize.
Exactly. Actually, the reason that Oprah Winfrey was the name I was looking for a few minutes ago. I actually thought about doing this because in my life, I have got people that I know from my university years. I have got people from my family as well. If they are doing something annoying, I have a huge tolerance for them because I know their story. Mm. Then I realized that if you know the story of the person, then suddenly your tolerance, your understanding increases enormously.
Huh. And then I wonder, because I think very often with family members, we lose the patience. And I think it's because we assume that we know them, but we actually don't. So we have never asked for the story to build the bridge.
Indeed. But in the end, we don't leave the family members. I mean, we say all the horrible things, but you know,
but nobody else is allowed to say these horrible things.
Exactly. You know, if another person came to a meeting and did this, you would say, stop doing this immediately.
Yes.
Whereas when your mom does something and your sister or brother does, or your son or daughter does it, but that does not increase from the decrease, the affection you have and understanding you have for the people.
Mm. True.
And in a way, in the corporate world, we forget the fact that we are all human beings. We are trained for that, for not to think that you are a human being. You have got a function to fulfill. So it would be good to remember that we are all human beings.
Yeah, so true. When you work with groups, what remains your number one facilitation challenge?
I always have this image that people coming to a workshop or a big team meeting, usually it must be waking up in the morning and saying, oh my God, there's a terrible meeting. There will be all 12 of us there. So most people come to group meetings thinking that it will not be exciting or useful. So my biggest challenge would be to make people feel that it will be fun, but not only fun, they will enjoy it, they will learn it, and with their different personality, they are welcome into it.
Mm.
So change that mindset from completely being saying that, oh my God, what am I doing, to saying, oh, this could be interesting. Let me express my opinion and also listen to other people's opinion. I mean, I want to create that environment in the beginning.
Which now makes me curious, when with the knowledge you have about the different motivators and the diversity, is it possible to craft an invitation that actually pushes all these buttons? So to have, because I'm thinking of many facilitators or team leaders who might listen to this show, they're inviting people to join workshops, meetings, group gatherings. So are there some wordings or some buttons we can push to make it more compelling for just anyone?
I'm sure you could, because I realize when listening to your question that I leave this job to the beginning of the meeting, not to the invitation stage before. Yes, but the prizes you put in the invitation can be different, covering a large proportion of that group. So you can say, you will find out about our plans for next year, as well as recognize getting to know the other team members and gaining recognition for the good things you have done last year. Mm-hmm. So that will cover quite a good percentage of people. Yeah. So you could draw the invitation to cover different motivation buttons.
Yeah.
And again, true that most invitations, the person drafting it reflects his own or her motivation buttons. We will talk about the P&L for last year, objectives for next year. So you do reflect it, but not everyone is excited from that.
Yeah. And true. And then And then obviously the design of the meeting or the gathering will also be reflected by their motivation. So if they're not interested in recognition, in conversation, collaboration, then it will be a PowerPoint presentation with only the results and only the numbers.
Correct. Although you do miss out something on that, of course. So because you can send out the presentation.
Yes, I mean, and that's where facilitation comes in, right? So I think all the managers can benefit from some.
Generally, because anything related to gaining the motivation of the people, their buy-in, etc., is so complicated. We love doing PowerPoint presentations, meetings with numbers and so forth. No emotions involved. It's like friends with benefits. It's, it's just absolutely no emotions. You just go through the motions, numbers, divide objectives, and it's finished. No complications. So it's the easy way of having a quiet meeting.
Yes. Disengaged and not sure whether the information will actually then land in the brains.
Correct. You see, say you are talking about next year's sales objectives or whatever, financial objectives. People must want that. And that's a great power when you manage to motivate the team behind that objective. It's a great, powerful thing, and you will not achieve it through presentation slides, PowerPoints.
Yeah, triggering curiosity. You mentioned something, if you mention these three words in an invitation, you will cover the biggest chunk.
I just made it up,
Yes. And this made me curious whether you do observe some trends. So are there motivators that apply to a majority of people, or is it an equal distribution across?
Probably we'd say there is quite a lot of variety of motivations. So I sort of hate ready-made capsuled motivation pills, like, for example, assuming that everyone will love being recognized and then put that into the invitation or to the opening speech, and because you are a wonderful people and you are great, so lucky to have you on this earth, sometimes works with other people, some people, and sometimes doesn't work. So some people like numbers, some people like results, some people like team spirit and so forth. So I don't like ready-made capsules.
And do you think that do we have different motivators in our different spheres of life? So would we be motivated in our private life by something different than in our professional life?
Yes. First of all, those three headings, which covers quite a lot of things: achievement, connection, and power, was what motivates you at work. Okay. There are completely other roots. It can be love. It can be sex. It can be religion. It can be national duty. First of all, you open quite a lot of categories in your private private life. And some people, for example, may feel very powerful in an environment. Say they are the CEO of a company. Everyone respects them, are scared from them and so forth. And when they come home, in the home, they say, don't forget to take out the rubbish tonight. It's Tuesday. So it can be different dynamics in your private life.
Yeah.
It can also be different dynamics with different people in your, like with your mom, you might have a different relationship than with your husband or your wife. And I remember you told me about the, was it the language of love or something like that?
Love languages.
Love languages. For example, my mom always said nice things about me and I always said nice things about her. And I assumed that was the way people speak to each other when they love each other. Then I got married and I couldn't understand. My wife was criticizing everything. And then one day I invited my mother-in-law to England. At the time, we were living in the UK. And I saw them washing dishes together. And they were saying to each other, don't put that glass like that. No, no, that's not good. Use that detergent. No, no, no. So they were criticizing each other to show their love. So I said, okay, maybe what she's doing to me is showing her love, showing that she cares about me and she doesn't have to speak to me like my mom. I will even go on this example. And then my brother-in-law was bringing girls to get married. And then she was treating them very badly, my ex-wife. And then one day a girl came in and she was like, we were in the beach and she was saying, put on the cream, you will have a sunburn. And then use your toes, this and she was completely complaining. And then I saw my wife saying, this is the right girl. This is the right girl. For her, yes. That was showing caring. Whereas with my mother and generally in my family, we make exaggerated compliments to each other. And that is how we show love to each other. And that drives our motivation.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Now we remember we had this conversation with the 5 love languages, I think, the acts of service, words of recognition, touch, gifts, and one other. And quality time.
Quality time.
Quality time. Okay. Yeah.
So you remember very well the headings. What I can say is that we express our love to other people with different languages, different ways, and that may not be the thing that excites the other person.
Yeah.
So you say, but I love you very much. And that may not be the argument for the other person.
If you really loved me, then you would buy me gifts, would buy me flowers.
Exactly. Not necessarily.
Yes. Yeah. True. And for me, this really helps me then also to connect to the motivation. That just because it motivates me doesn't mean that it motivates the other in order to get them to do what I want.
Precisely.
Sound nice, but yeah. Then I need to speak their motivation language.
Precisely.
Yeah.
A guy meets a girl and then suddenly throws the car key of an expensive car on the table and talks about they drank the most expensive champagne. And that might be completely repulsive for that girl who might want some other things in that person. So good motivators, good communicators, read the motivators of the other side, and they don't do something until they are sure about the motivators. So that's a good thing. Don't assume your motivation will be the same as the one. So usually you spend some time with a chit-chat, and you will recognize. You will say, this is this is the excitement of the person. Then let me feed and then test it.
Yeah.
And then see, it does work. Then you are on the right path. Maybe it's not the right path. You try another one until you find the right key.
Do you have something like a silver bullet question that helps you I remember you mentioned the provocation, the little conflict, but maybe there's a question that reveals people's motivation.
I don't. I'm very much of a come as you are type of thing. I probably behave a lot with my instinct. Mm-hmm. I actually don't like standard questions. No, I don't. The short answer is I don't.
Fair enough. One last question that I always ask, and I don't want to skip it, although we touched upon it a bit, but I want to ask it explicitly. According to your experience in group work, what makes a workshop fail?
Actually, what makes the workshop fail is what I said before, which was not making the people feel welcome mm-hmm. with their different personalities. That is definitely a very important thing. I will go on. Usually in a workshop, people represent different interests. They represent the interests of the finance, different interests of marketing, interests of sales, etc. And a facilitator has to pull those people out of that. And that is the... So you asked me for one, I gave you two. So... A facilitator has to make the group behave as a group and not individuals come together.
Create a shared purpose.
Yes.
Shared motivation.
Precisely.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Amit.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, actually.
You seem surprised.
Yes. You know, I'm 62 since a month now, and it's amazing how much you discover, even in an interview like that or in a coaching session, and then you answer questions and you recognize, oh, so this is my answer to it. So a lot of the things that I don't know about the questions and I don't prepare for it. And so when I heard your questions, I sort of give my best answer and I say, oh, this is not a bad answer, you know.
Yeah, and I invite you to listen to the podcast again when it comes out, because very often it's very interesting then to re-listen and like, oh, that's what I thought. This makes sense.
You know,
you might be able to learn from yourself.
Hear their own voice, recorded voice. I hope I will be saying to myself, oh no, my God, did I say this? And with this tone of voice and so forth. So do let me know when the podcast comes out.
I will.
It will be my first podcast to listen in my life. There's always new things in your life. So I will be listening to it.
And we will put the links and the link to the motivation buttons and how to connect to you to learn more in the show notes.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It was a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much for very, very good questions.
Thank you. Thank you for staying tuned and for listening until the very end. I hope that you found the inspiration and the wisdom that you are looking for. And I hope that you will subscribe to the show so that you never miss any of the interviews with another inspiring facilitator from across the world. I'm devoted to continue this podcast and to deliver weekly an episode that maintains the quality that you expect and you deserve. And if you would like to help me to maintain this quality and to keep the podcast free, please help us. Visit workshops.org/support to make a small donation to keep the podcast free. Thank you so much. I hope to be in your ears next week.